Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Basketball News Podcast Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. How are you doing, sir?
Doing well, doing great. Excited to be here. Happy to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for embracing your bounce. I'm fired up. That's a warning. You're listening.
It's a warning.
I'm ready to go. It's March. It's madness. There's mad takes going all over the place. You wrote
an Isaiah. That's why they call it March Madness.
Well done. Nikias wrote an Isaiah Thomas article after slandering for 100 episodes.
Wait a minute. I just slandered for 100 episodes.
People just discovered Memphis plays Whip That Trick. I've been doing it for 6 years.
Well, you know, they finally got the ESPN behind the scenes access. So, you know, they're certified now.
They're certified now. Okay. All right. Let's go.
They're here.
There we go. And we have a guest on today's episode. We have Siri Sohi of The Ringer joining us. How are you, ma'am?
I'm good. I'm excited to be here.
I am ready to rock it out. Before we get into, I guess, all of the fun stuff, let's get into some housekeeping, some news. One, Kyrie Irving is back full time. The mandate has been lifted, adjusted, however you want to phrase that. Siri, what does Kyrie being back, does that alter your opinion on Brooklyn's ceiling at all? Or how do you feel about Brooklyn this year?
I'm a lot more optimistic about them now than I was probably at any other point in the season. Just because, like, they're finally starting to play. Sometimes they're starting to play defense. Like, they have more games than not where they do, I guess. And they also just, I want to save this, a lot of this, for the discussion we have about Boston. Because I feel like they answer some of the Boston questions that we have pretty well. But in general, two absolutely scintillating scorers, really good spacing around them. And it kind of looks like what I hoped I'd see in the playoffs last year, which is like a team that just fits really well together. Like, they don't really need that many games played together. But I was already kind of optimistic with, like, hey, I mean, you know, Kyrie playing four away games is pretty good. Now that he's back, it's just like, you know, they can actually be a real team now. You know, we don't know what's going to happen with Ben Simmons, but that to me is the biggest thing. Just the fact that we're not, like, playing this game anymore of, like, hey, this is how many road games they have left to get some more chemistry. Like, they can just, even they only have a few more weeks till the playoffs, but they can be a little bit normal. Like, that's good.
Nice chemistry building stretch for them. Steve, how are you, where are you at on Brooklyn now?
Oh, I mean, I was intrigued after what they had done when Kyrie was back with KD, the scoring ability they had displayed. It made a lot of their lineups make a lot more sense. It makes a lot of the progress they tried to make defensively make a lot more sense. And those are two guys that can hurt you in the playoffs. We all know that. Take your scheme and throw it in the trash. Take your game plan and throw it in the trash. So that elevated them. But now the question was, hey, is he going to play? As y'all stated, it's over. So now it becomes, where do they land and how much danger do they present? But having Kyrie, that's a big plus, especially with the way he's playing. Now, my mind just goes to, somebody knew something. Somebody knew something. Kyrie was gone and then Kyrie comes back. The timing, I'm just going to leave it there. Somebody called the Yankees.
Are we letting the conspiracies fly?
Kyrie was way too calm and the Nets were way too chill. That's all I'm going to say.
But isn't that just like their perpetual state?
One out of two.
Like, I feel like even when Kyrie's mad, when he's like, when you read a quote from Kyrie and then you hear him say it, they become two completely different things every single time, especially the controversial ones. But that's not to say that I don't want to let your theory, you know, like, that's just an observation about their general mental demeanor. It's always gone. But I'm here for this, though.
Nah, quick crossover on my theory. It's fine.
I respect it. While we're talking about demeanors, there was some fun had in Miami during their loss to the Golden State Warriors, in which Eric Spoelstra is throwing clipboards and Udonis Haslam is threatening to engage in fisticuffs with Jimmy Butler, I guess is a way to put that. Steve, as someone that's
just how they act, you know, that's just their thing. that's just their thing. That's just how they are every day. You know, like we might not get it, right? Like, we're just not a part of heat culture, but like, if you were in that locker room, they throw clipboards, they throw everything. They throw iPads, you know, Jordans, whatever.
Not Jordans.
They have food fights. It's just what they do, guys. We just wouldn't get it.
So you fall on the side of this just not being a big deal. It's just,
I mean, I'm kind of doing a bit, but I also genuinely believe that to be true, like on a less dramatic level. Yeah. Like that's kind of essentially what was said after the game as well. We've seen this for a while. Like this is why the Jimmy Butler pairing works and worked. These are all people who have, like, I don't know what it is. Like they either enjoy that type of communication style, or they, you know, are at least not bothered by it. They don't take it personally, just like what they're used to.
I got you. Steve, you had thoughts on your timeline about this. Where did you land on the engagement?
Man, these things happen. I mean, J.R. Smith threw a bowl of soup.
Food fights.
This is like, basketball is basketball. This is a lot of time spent together. It's a competitive environment. It's a passionate environment. These things happen. And sometimes they happen in the public eye. Like, for every one of these, there's about 7 during the season that most people don't know about, even in today's leaky state of things where you seem to know all the information. This kind of stuff happens. And what I did was, first off, Spo was mad. Spo was mad, mad. I don't know what Jimmy Butler said in that timeout huddle, but it was flagrant, because you saw Spo's reaction, you saw PJ Tucker's reaction, and then Udonis lost his mind. Anyways, I judge it by the other players and the staff and what they're doing during it. And if Markieff Morris is chilling, then I'm cool. Like, if Dwayne Dedmon is playing peacemaker, I'm good. Like, if Kyle Lowry is motioning to the refs, hey, we need another timeout, I'm cool. If Yurt Seven is just putting his hands in his pockets, trying not to get involved, Tyler Hero is just kind of mumbling around. Like, it's, these things happen. And this is one of those things that if you have the right culture, you can work through it, get past it, and then you start making jokes about it. Like, Tyler Hero, what were you about to do in the sweatsuit? Like, we've seen you in the punching video. So, no, I don't think it's a big deal. I think that's Miami. They're fired up. These things happen. Spo getting that mad was interesting, but he's a competitor.
Yeah, it just felt like a lot of frustration boiling over. Like, they're fresh off the loss to Philadelphia without their stars. And then they're in the midst of giving up, I think, a 19-0 run to the Golden State Warriors to start the third quarter of that game without Steph. So I think that general frustration and whatever else is going on, like, I'm not in the locker room, so I don't know what they have going on personally or whatever, but you can understand things boiling over. And to your point, like, the bench didn't seem to be in, like, an oh, crap, what's going on situation. It was like, oh, here we go again.
That was also just one of those games, you know? Like, I think both teams kind of walked into that being like, we really don't want to lose after what we did the night before. Mm. And, you know, it was kind of defensive slugfest. And for the Warriors, it's kind of just framing, right? Like, for the Warriors, it was impressive because they didn't have their guys. But for the Heat, it was more frustrating because they did, and they just didn't get any sort of rhythm going on offense. But it was just that kind of game. Like, I think you can, like, in defensive game, I think, like, your temper is just more likely to flare up anyways. Mm-hmm. It's just like environment.
Well, yeah. So I guess we all land on the side of, like, weird to see on TV, but not a big deal overall.
I think so far. Yeah. I mean, like, I think it's a situation to monitor though, because they do have to land the plane, right? Like, you can't just assume that because they have a great culture that it's going to be okay.
Mm-hmm. It should.
But generally not worried.
I mean, anytime you can have a conversation where you, like, do 7 circles and continue the conversation around everyone, I tend to think you're going to be all right.
It's funny. They, for all the theatrics and stuff, like, they went on a run after after that discussion. Yeah. Kyle Lowry lost his mind. So maybe not so much trouble in paradise in Miami. All right. We have a guest we're going to vibe out today. That seems to be the theme of the podcast. So we are going to go to the mailbag.
Oh, I thought this was going to be a celebration of Chris Paul returning. My bad.
Hey, man, he had a nice kick out to Devin Booker for a
kick. No, you didn't. All right. The mailbag. Yo, email us your questions.
There we go. If you have
questions. I don't have the password.
Oh, here we go. If you have questions for us, please shoot them over to dunkerspot@yahoo.com. We are going to kick things off with a general question from Daniel, who asked, what is your favorite thing about basketball? Mine is post play. Just find it fascinating to see two athletes going at it in the post using strength and strategy in such a short time frame. Sirit, what is your favorite thing about basketball?
This is such an awesome question. Like, especially like reading this over and it being the first question, I was just so happy. It was like, you don't get to think about this enough. Passing though. Passing has always been my favorite part of the game. Flashy passing, but just, you know, intrepid, smart passing, like finding space where there isn't, has always been my favorite part of the game. I grew up falling in love with basketball because of Steve Nash. And, you know, now there's a whole bunch of guys in the league that like have really built off what he's done, and it's never been more creative. So that's definitely my favorite part. And it's super fun right now.
There we go. Steve, what is your favorite part about basketball?
I mean, I could go on and on, but I won't. My favorite part is when it becomes a chess match, when two teams are facing each other and you can tell they know what the other team is going to do. So the defense is locked in, taking things away. The offense is countering, moving the ball. That's my favorite part. When we see those possessions, those little things. Like, I'm a big little thing person. Like when a player sets up a play before it happens. You know, KD pointing for the ball, saying he has a mismatch. Now he gets it. Now he scores. Now you piece it together afterwards. Nikias, go with yours before I go on a rant.
I will give you the floor. I will kick it to you, let you ice on the left wing. What you got?
It's just, I like watching just the mentality of players. Like, say your team's having a rough night or you're having a rough night and you're able to still find a way to compete, find a way to win, find a way to contribute. Just those type of things. Executing plays, scoring out of multiple options out of the same set. That's one of my favorite things. If you run the same play over and over and you score three different ways, I'm gonna be enjoying myself. Guys coming off the bench, having big nights out of nowhere. That's one of my favorite things too. When you're out of the rotation and you stayed ready and now you get your opportunity and you shine, I love that. I'm gonna stop. Go, Nikias.
I feel like mine is like a combination of you two. I'm with Sirit. Like, I have a huge passing nut, so that always does it. And then for you with the chess matches, I just love watching great playmakers like manipulate like weak side defenders. I love watching guys operate big role. I think this is why I lean so much towards watching Phoenix and watching them spam like Spain and stuff, because they make you wrong no matter what you do, no matter what your coverage is. And so watching like Chris Paul direct traffic and pick and roll, watching Luka Doncic play like 3 miles per hour and just put weak side defenders in, that just put them in pick your poison situations. James Harden's the same way. This is why I've always, again, like, I've had my things to say about James Harden this year, and that's effort-based. But in general, this is why I've always enjoyed watching James Harden play basketball. You get annoyed by the pace or some of the extra stuff that comes with him, but that man is a genius on the basketball court. Jokic in the high post. Like, it's fun watching the smartest players in basketball manipulate defenses, kind of bend to their will. Let's move on to Jacob, who has a couple of questions for us. His first one, if you had a defensive-minded wing, would you rather him be able to size down and guard the 1 and 2 as well as the 3, or size up and guard the 4 and 5? And he compares it to a Mikal Bridges versus like OG Anunoby question. Steve, I'll start that one with you. Which would you rather have?
I mean, the easy answer is to say we'll let him do both, but that's not the question. Good question, Jacob. I would rather him be able to size down and guard 1 through 3 for me. More pressure points are going to be there. Not to say that 4 and 5 doesn't present its issues, but I'd rather you be able to guard multiple of their top scorers if they have those type of lineups, be able to guard those guys, switch, start a possession on them, those kind of things. We can always scram you out of a matchup of 4 or 5 if you can't do that. For me, the flip side is if you can not guard 1 through 3, now you're become a liability of sorts. You end up looking like Tobias Harris in that Hawks Sixers series. And now that gets exploited. Now your team's in a rough spot. So if I had my choice on my wing, give me the one who can guard 1 through 3. We can work around that.
Okay. Sirit, what about you?
This was a really good question. I thought about this like for a while, but I kind of fell in the same position too. Just because there's also, I think there's more solutions to, you know, the 4 or 5 position as well. and there are more dangerous scorers from the 1 to 3 right now in the NBA. And in general, it's just, you know, I think this might be cheating the question a little bit, but on switches, I just kind of trust an undermatched smaller player more than I trust an undermatched bigger player. You know what I mean? Like, I think there's more guys that would be able to hold their own in the post, for example, or be able to kind of spell that if it's not their advantage, especially if they're a good defender, than, you know, having like a slower footed guy stuck on the perimeter. Like, it's just death, you know, like it just becomes the thing that pretty much everybody else in the NBA has figured out how to exploit. Right. Whereas, you know, I think with like the post players, there's just some guys where there's only a few guys where they're definitely going to be able to exploit that. Right. Like, you got your Jokic's, you've got your Embiid's, right. Like, but other, and then, you know, you got Durant, but, you know, for the most part, like on every NBA team, there's going to be somebody who can exploit a slow footed 7-footer. Right. And that's kind of not to say that guy would, that the player playing the three would be, you know, that dramatically bad, I guess, but it's just more likely, I guess.
I got you.
Oh. But it's a tough one.
Oh, I was going to say, before you go, Nikias, to that point, you look at a team like, say, Denver, for example. Mm-hmm. If I switch my guard onto Jeff Green, I might feel okay with my chances, and I might hope you just go ahead and try and post him up, because now I don't have to deal with X, Y, and Z. So, yeah, I'm with
you. Yeah, that's a good point. It's a good point.
I guess this is going to be a clean consensus. I would also take the 1 through 3. And to that point, like, I would want a wing that can hang with smaller guards. And then beyond that, even if you are overmatched, you can't guard up. You look at a team like Boston that's so good at, like, scramming you out of mismatches. A team like Miami that can scram you out of mismatches. Like, I think there are more avenues to help you out if you are overmatched as a smaller player versus being a wing that can't really defend guards, because you are likely getting blown by and putting the rest of your defense in rotation at that point. So that is where I would land. As for Jacob's second question, he asks, how important is it for a middle-of-the-pack playoff team, like a 4-8 seed, to attempt new things and lineups as opposed to trying their best to win every game for seeding? Is it a mix? Do you focus on what you do well and try to do it better, or add more wrinkles and actions or disguises or different lineups to see how it works? Steve, I'll pose that one to you.
I love this question. And the word new is probably what hung me up a little bit. If you're a middle of the pack playoff team, you should know who you are by now. So you should be fine tuning things more than anything else. I think this may be a time to show some things maybe you've been working on that you haven't displayed as much so far in the regular season. Maybe try some different lineup combinations, some small lineups. Maybe try and see what a different look grouping looks like, or give more of a playoff-like rotation in that way. But I wouldn't say this is the time to try and do something you've never done before. You know, if you want to come out in a game and say, hey, let's really just focus on switching this game, and that's something you've done before and you just want to see what it looks like against a certain team that works. Or if you want to say, hey, let's go with this small lineup, I get that. But trying something brand new out the box at this time of the year, not the best idea. You should have all your things in your back pocket, have the cards you want to play, and let them loose. The most important thing, though, is winning, especially with this play-in concept now. For me, at least, I can't get past that. Just having been in a scenario where you win 50 games and you're fighting for the 7 seed in the last game of the season. Like, if you don't win, a lot of it don't matter. So you're focusing on yourself while still trying to improve on some of the weaknesses you're afraid to see going forward, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So you take a team like, let's just say Utah, for example, who has certain question marks, and certain teams are playing them a different way, like a Boston. Right, we're going to drop everything, switch everything else, and now you got to figure it out, and you don't have Bogdanovich. Okay, this is an opportunity for us to see what that looks like, get that on film, and now trying to split that the next game. So it's kind of focusing on your warts while also trying to get humming. You know, you need momentum. You need to be moving in the right direction at this time of the season. You may have question marks, but you want to feel like you're imposing your will on the game, as opposed to, you know, what happened to the Wolves against the Suns last night, where the Suns just said, ha, nope.
I got you. Sierra, what about you?
So this is a really interesting question. I think for me, it just comes down to, you want to always be the type of team that's able to reconfigure without it feeling like too dramatic a move, right? Like, to Steve's point, if you're a team that's been like rigid and kept the same starting lineup for the entire season, then come March, you're starting to make some change. It's like, okay, all right, like what's going on? Because like, I think sometimes making those changes can have a psychological effect on a team, right? But if you're the type of team that's used to that type of thing, where the starting lineup is always a little bit different, and you know, you're always tinkering with different schemes and stuff, like Boston's a great example, just like consistently using different defenses and things like that. Like, first of all, you want to just do that anyways. Like, this getting through, you know, four rounds of the playoffs now, you're going to meet a whole bunch of different types of teams. Like, there's no real archetype left in the NBA anymore. You got to be very adaptable. So you want to have that kind of baked in the first place. And then from there, it's like, yeah, like, you know, the idea of not of experimentation versus losing is, I think, a little bit outdated now too. I don't know if it's ever really been the case. Like, I think teams that experiment more are more likely to win. Like, the more times you try something, the better you are, the better you're likely to get at it. And also, I think it keeps teams more mentally engaged too. Like, it creates smarter basketball players. It creates smarter basketball staffers too. So in general, like, experimentation, good. And do it no matter who you are, like from 1 to 16. And don't worry about the wins. Like, you'll win. Or you'll win more than you would have. Unless you're doing like some absolute like batshit bananas stuff. But like, if you look at like the Cavs, right? Like, the big lineups that played in the playoffs, I mean, in the preseason, they were supposed to be like, oh, a fun, cute like thing that they're trying. And it ended up being this thing where now you have like the entire NBA is back to playing like two bigs now. Well, not the entire NBA, but you guys know what I'm saying. Like, this back half of the season has been a complete return to that.
I got you. This was a fun question for me. What hung me up was trying to figure out what middle of the pack meant. Like, if that just meant like the literal seeding, or, you know, like the mid 2010s, like Pacers, in which they're like solid, but you don't know, like, the ceiling seems a bit capped.
So in, like, those cases, it's like, do anything, please.
Did you just take out Indiana?
No, I didn't. Like, I'm just trying to give a prefix. Because, like, you know, Utah has been hovering around like 3, 4, 5 all year. And so they're technically middle of the pack, but they're also a team with title aspirations. So with them, you know, a link that I made this year or earlier this season was like, okay, maybe they could be. They're going to approach this season like Milwaukee did last year, where it's like, okay, we know our base system could get us 50, 55 wins, top offense, top defense, whatever, but we need to be able to adjust in the postseason. So we're going to use it that way. So for a team like Utah, I'm like, yeah, the experimentation is more important for you because you already kind of know what your baseline is, as opposed to a team like Cleveland this year, which has been in that 4-8 range for most of the year. But they also seem to be exceeding expectations. So for them, I feel like it's more understandable if it's just, okay, we're just trying to win and we're trying to establish where we are in the standings versus working on playoff counters, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Like, if that's not even necessarily like what you're thinking about doing or where you feel like you are in your timeline, that makes sense. And the other thing is that if you are one of those 1-4 seeds or 1-3, then, you know, you can afford to lose some games and see. I think this applies also to like playing less minutes and, you know, just giving young guys more rotation minutes and stuff, like real rotation minutes. It just feels like, especially like as the regular season becomes more and more useless, it's just like, you know, why not turn this whole thing into a playground? That might be where the NBA actually kind of got to finally, like this past season, right? Like, we just have so many different styles of defense, especially, but, you know, just on mostly on defense, I would say, actually, that have really only come from, like, you know, coaches tinkering and trying new styles.
I could see that. Like, that's a good point. Steve, were you about to jump in?
Oh, no, I was just bouncing off of what y'all were saying, because my mind went to thinking about how much of the experimentation depends on how good your base is. And how good you feel about that. You might be more comfortable trying different things, like a Milwaukee at this point of the year, where, hey, let's see what combinations work. And I think the other interesting point is, we talk about middle of the pack, there's also the play-in teams. And then that becomes a game-to-game, we need to live or try and figure it out. But I feel like for most of those times for these teams we're talking about, you kind of see more adjustments now throughout mm-hmm. some of these games where they may try something at the start and then say, okay, that's not working. Let's try something else as opposed to just sticking with their base. Because as y'all stated, it's important to have that versatility in the playoffs now. You're not going to be able to survive just doing A. You need to be able to do A, B, and C and probably toggle between them. So it's fun. This is a fun question.
I like it. I like it. Our next one, we have our first MVP question of the mailbag.
I can't wait. I can't wait. Guys, keep that same energy. Let's go.
Keep that same energy. It's more of a statement than a question, but from Shakir, he says, regarding MVP voting, if the Nuggets drop to the seventh seed and finish with under 50 wins, how can people still vote for him over Giannis and Embiid, two players who will finish the season as the best players on top three seeded teams in the East? A large part of modern-day MVP voting is team success, and in the last 20 years, only one player has won MVP without reaching 50 wins. That's Russell Westbrook. It wouldn't sit right with me if Jokic won, despite the phenomenal statistical season he's having and the overall impact he has on the team. I feel it. Like, I get it.
Yeah, I'm not mad at this day. Sorry, go ahead.
Steve is already laughing. Like, I understand being like, if Jokic finishes with like 48, Jokic, like he's his own team. But like, if Jokic finishes with 48 wins or something, 47, 48 wins, and you have Giannis and Embiid in the low mid 50s, then I could understand looking like, okay, winning is supposed to matter. The Nuggets are in the play-in. What are we doing here? I think that ignores a little bit of context just because he's been so dominant himself and the circumstances around his team being in seven right now. And that's a recent development with Minnesota now being like the best team in the West since the All-Star break.
It's also worth noting that the Nuggets are only two wins behind the Bucks and the Sixers.
Yeah, like there isn't a large gap there. Mm-hmm. And so I struggle to go straight with Milwaukee, Philly 2-3, Denver 7, therefore Jokic eliminated. Like, I'm not opposed to you get someone giving MVP to Giannis or Embiid, but I would like a slightly better reason than that, considering the roster context for everyone.
Yeah. I think the devil's advocate take here, just like the fact that he won it last year, would be like, don't we need a little bit of extra justification to give it to him back to back?
Yeah, I could see
that's the one right there.
Yeah, I guess the primary case for that would just be like, he's been better than he was last year.
That's a fair point. He's been significantly better. I'm very conflicted about MVP voting this year. I don't really know what I'm going to do. But I tend to lean towards Giannis. I tend to lean towards Giannis because, okay, Jokic has improved defensively this year, but I mean, Giannis is a force and the Bucks are worse defensively, but he's also been asked to make up for a lot. And I don't know, like the only reason he's not having like career statistical highs is because he's not playing a lot of minutes, which is the absolute smartest thing to do, because why the hell would you? And they've had a ton of injuries this year too.
And he's still slapping up 30, 12, and 6. And he's in the mix for the best player of the year this year. Like, it's wild what Giannis has been able to do. Steve, did you want to jump in, good sir?
I was just curious because you mentioned some points as far as that shouldn't dock him. What if that's a tiebreaker to some folks? Like, maybe they say, hey, Jokic has the stats. Giannis has been incredible on both ends. Embiid's been a monster. What if it just comes down to, I don't know how to pick, and that record ends up being the tiebreaker? How do you feel about that?
Sure.
I'd get it. Like, I just, my thing is, if that's the tiebreaker, sure. If that's just, all right, we knocking you out because your team is finishing here, MVPs don't finish here, you're done, while ignoring what Jokic has done and what Jokic has done with his context. Like, that feels weird to me. Like, even with the Westbrook example being brought up, like, I think Jokic has been better than Westbrook was during the MVP season.
Oh, he's much better than Westbrook was during the MVP season.
So, like, I'm not sure how much I get it. Again, I just need a little bit more than that. Like, I feel like this has to be mm-hmm. a Embiid/Giannis have been better than Jokic in this area versus team didn't win when Jokic has been missing number two and number three all year?
They've interestingly all had similar sort of plot lines too, where they've kind of had to deal with a lot. Like Embiid's got definitely the most talent on his team, but he also, you know, the team was going through the Ben Simmons situation. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's necessarily like, hey, like Embiid should be the MVP because of that, but he did also carry them through some games that, you know, if he wasn't as good as he was, like maybe the Sixers are in a lower leverage position come trade mm-hmm. deadline and don't get Harden. Like that could factor into it. But they've all just like, you know, just been dealing with a lot of, I think Giannis probably doesn't get enough credit for the Bucks injuries or like the Bucks in general. Like that's just not been part of the plot for some reason. Like we talk about like the Bucks defense not being as good this year. And just a general drop off. And we talk about Giannis and we just don't talk about the fact that Drew and Middleton missed a bunch of games. And when all those guys are healthy, they're still really good.
Dominant.
Like just as good, if not better than they were last year. Like even like the Lopez stuff. Like, man, Portis has just become him. It's fine. It's fine.
See, I needed Giannis to take off because I can't stand doing Jokic versus Embiid. It's my least favorite basketball conversation in the world because they're both insane. They're both great at different things.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't necessarily want to choose mm-hmm. because, I mean, Joel Embiid averaged 30 for what, two straight months?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's not an easy feat. And Jokic is number one in what, every Nikolaitic in the world?
Is that what we're calling it?
Yes, all the time. Now, side note, they got to stop with that on national TV. Don't put up the screenshot of all the advanced categories that he's leading in. Not at least when that's the first thing you do. Like, Jokic is a bucket getter. Display that to people, please. Like, this is a guy who will walk to the post very casually, face up, look you dead in the eye, and then shoot right over you.
No, but his touch time, though.
But no.
Also, I also talk about his touch time a lot. This is just a joke directed against myself.
Oh, but no, I'm glad you made that point because I feel like part of the Jokic discourse and how wonky it is that for people that don't watch him regularly, the advanced numbers seem to be the easy introduction to folks. And not everyone is willing to go there with advanced numbers right now. So you're already like not meeting people where they are.
I feel like the best comp for those guys is to say like Joel is like the Kobe of playing the five and Jokic is like the Curry. Like you'll both unstoppable. You'll take either of them, but very distinctly different play styles that lend themselves like different systems as well.
I like that. Wait a minute. You might've did something.
Oh yeah. It was done.
It was done.
It was done.
That ain't bad. That ain't bad at all.
Now, Nikias, you want to talk about your fourth, fifth MVP voting? Oh, you want to talk about your distraction and disdain for the MVP having five players on it?
I don't have a general disdain.
Let's talk awards, but this is the framing.
Like, I guess my thing is, like, why are we up in arms about it? Like, my general thing with award talk is, like, talk to me if the player that you want to talk about has a case to win the award. And so, like, that's my personal baseline for having, like, deep conversation about it. Other than that, it's just like, okay, cool. Devin Booker is really good at basketball. I knew that already. If you're framing it into a conversation, like, I don't think Devin Booker has a case for number one. And so if you bring up Devin Booker within the framework of Devin Booker should win MVP, and then I say no, then the conversation is inherently negative.
And should win MVP or get MVP love, two different things.
But that leads me to, what is MVP love?
Or should they be in the MVP conversation? That's another way we like to put it.
Yeah.
Or the conversation before the conversation.
Right. Like, my conversation is who should win. That's what I want to talk about in this case. And that's why, for me, the conversation has been dominated by Jokic and Embiid, by Giannis, you know, Steph early on this year. that's, you know, we talked about this on the pod earlier this year. That's kind of where the DeRozan stuff was starting to bug me a little bit. I'm just like, you know, we can talk about how great he's been this season, the scoring bench that he's on, what he's doing with the Chicago team that I've been very wrong about, without being, hey, he should win MVP. I'm just like, no, I don't think that's true, but that's okay.
I think this is just, more than anything, it's just a failure of finding creative ways to say somebody's having a really good season. Because, like, if you say someone's having an all-star season, then it's like, well, yeah, but that's not really what we're trying to demonstrate when we're talking about, like, the tear that DeMar was on or Devin Booker. But he does, like, yeah, he's not in that top three. Nobody else is, right? But we also don't necessarily say, like, hey, he's a first-team All-NBA-er. Like, that just, you know, doesn't really roll off the tongue. It's just, I think it's just a way that we talk about things, especially in March, right? Like, cause we already know at this point, like we already know, like we've had the MVP conversation for like the latter half of the season. It's either one of those three guys. Nobody's mad if you pick any of those three. We got to talk about something else. We got to find a way to talk about something else. So, hey, this guy, could he sneak into the conversation? Could he punch his way up into the conversation before the conversation? That's just what we do.
I guess that's just kind of where I'm like, we don't have to do this. Like,
we do, though, because it's March 24th and there's 3 weeks until the playoffs. So we have to do it, guys. That's how it goes.
I get it. I'm just like, talk about these guys all year and we don't have to try to force them into MVP conversations to give them love.
No, we could do that. We could try that instead.
I'm going to count it, guys.
Okay.
What's wrong with recognizing folks for having a good year? So you say your conversation is, hey, who's winning? I get that. What's wrong with nominating 4 and 5? Like, Gary Payton got MVP votes during the MJ years. That's a thing that happened. Was he the MVP? Probably not. But someone was like, hey, MJ's going to win. Let me recognize somebody else. Is that inherently bad? I'm curious.
Inherently
bad. I like that we're just delving into philosophy here. Yeah,
this is beautiful.
Yeah. Is anything inherently bad? I'm more of like utilitarian myself.
Now we're getting into the deep stuff. So like, I knew GP Gessen. You got it. So when you say Gary Payton got MVP vote, did he actually get first place votes or was he like in the...
Yes, he did.
Then, you got a first place vote?
1998.
No, okay, see like, yes, that's inherently bad to me because I don't think... As great as Pete Gary Payton was, last guard to win Defensive Player of the Year, all that good stuff, Sonics to the finals, cool. I don't think Gary Payton was Gary Payton better than MJ? Was Gary Payton a legitimate, he should win the MVP guy? I don't like, as a concept, and I've talked about this on my timeline, I think I've talked about this on the podcast too, like, in general, I do not like casting he deserves recognition votes. This always bugs me once we get into like all NBA teams. Specifically, where it's just like, hey, this guy's been really good. And it's like, all right, cool. Has he been a top six guard? Has he been a top six forward? Has he been a top three center? No. What are we talking about? And like, that sounds a lot harsher than I mean it, but like, that's just kind of how I think about award races.
No, it's like we were talking about before the show. Like, I thought this was going to be a very spicy conversation, but you just said like, he just isn't in the top three. And I was like, that's not mean. It just sounds mean. Yeah. But it's fine. It's just true. he's still Devin Booker at the end of the day. Right.
So like with the Gary Payton thing, it's just like you can talk about, write about, acknowledge how great Gary Payton was during that season without saying, hey, Gary should win MVP, because the answer is no, he shouldn't. Like that's not what the spirit of the vote should be for, in my opinion. Like maybe that's just me being original, being literal, but like that's me.
But I feel like they're two different things. So I don't feel like it hurts the spirit of the vote to me. I like the MVP discussion. So I'll come right there. Okay. My favorite is going throughout the year and going from 10 to 8 to 5 to, ooh, maybe someone else shuffled back in. Like for me, I've had some pretty consistent names, but Steph Curry dropped out. And now I'm thinking, does Kevin Durant go back into my top 5? DeMar's been in. Ja's been in the whole time. What about Devin Booker? Does he go into my top 5? Does DeMar face DeRozan? Like, I have fun with that conversation. Doesn't mean they're going to win MVP. And when these guys get that recognition of a top five MVP type deal, that's something that like sticks. Like, you can Google that Tim Hardaway was sixth in 1998 in the MVP voting.
It's Joakim Noah came in fifth.
See, like,
I think it was 2016, right?
2016? It's a badge of honor. It's pride. It's recognition. It's acknowledging you had a great year. So while it may not impact the overall MVP vote, I think it's a neat discussion to have, even if it's a sub discussion underneath the top three. I don't want to dismiss the great season. Hey, he was great. Salute to you.
Here's a question though. Like, is there not like a fundamental flaw in the MVP, you know, award at this point anyways? Like, if I was a player that wanted to win a championship, I'd be running in the other direction from the MVP award, because if you win the MVP, you're just not going to win a championship. That's just kind of how it goes, unless you're Steph Curry, at least in like the last 20 years. Like, there's very few players, I think it's like five in the last like 22 years or 23 years that have won the MVP and then won a championship, because like the award has now become all about dependency. Like, is there, maybe we should be having this discussion a different way, where like you do look at a player like Devin Booker and say like, wait, should he be in the MVP discussion? Because the Suns are the number one seed, and he's the only guy on that team that, you know, if he's out for, like, you know, you've lost Chris Paul for a chunk of the season, lost Ayton for a chunk of the season, found a way to spell those guys. I don't think you can necessarily do that with Booker. And he's the best player on that team. He's their closer. And he's still putting up incredible numbers. Like, I think he's just like doing his regular 26, 5, and 5 thing like he always does. And like, I don't know, like that they're the one seed by a mile. They're the best team in the NBA. They're like the team that I have the most faith in going into the playoffs. And like, what, just because they're well balanced, like they should, like the individuals on that team shouldn't get recognition?
Oh, was that the end? I didn't want to cut you off.
No, that's it. Yeah, that's all I had.
Oh, okay. I hear you. Especially in light of Phoenix being as good as they are. Like, I don't think it's fair for him to be docked for Phoenix being really good. Mm-hmm. Because, like, there was, like, a stretch early in the year where he missed some games and, like, Paul Ake were able to keep it going. And then we just saw what Booker did without Paul, and he was able to keep it going. I guess this is why, like, earlier today, like, I asked people, like, okay, what exactly is your MVP criteria? Because I feel like that's where a lot of the conversation kind of goes left, too. Because once you have the discussion about Booker, it's like, hey, why is he not in it? And it's like, well, people told us that you had to do this, this, and this. And now that he's doing this and this, now it feels like the goalposts have been moved. And it's just like, mm-hmm. I'm not sure there's maybe been like a skeleton of what the MVP criteria is. But like, there's never been like a firm set, you have to do these three things in order to win MVP.
That's kind of the fun of it, no?
Like, I guess it depends on what side you fall on it. Like, I think with Booker in particular, I feel like a lot of the frustration from Suns fans or just Booker fans in general is that his narrative arc has not been fair. Like, he came into the league as, you saw him at Kentucky, like, he was an off-ball guy, shooter. He gets thrust into an on-ball role, looks better than expected. He's basically playing point guard for them with an awful cast, with management being bad. He's putting up numbers, but he's not winning. So, like, he gets dubbed as the empty calories guy. And then you see what they do in the bubble when they actually have a solid point guard in Ricky Rubio. And then Chris Paul comes, and Devin Booker is still good. And then it's, well, now the Suns are good because of Chris Paul, which was not fair. And now the Suns are doing this, and Devin Booker is still good. And then it's Devin Booker still not the MVP. Which I don't think he is, but I could also understand where that frustration comes in, where it's like, okay, for Devin Booker specifically, what else does he have to do to get recognition for how good he is?
That's the fun, though. Like, I like hearing different cases for different players, even if they're not necessarily for the MVP. Like, I don't think I would say Devin Booker should be the MVP. But if you want to say Devin Booker should be up there, I would understand it. I get it.
In the conversation.
Yeah, in the conversation. As we like,
we come full circle.
Full circle. It's what we do. I don't like group think. So I like that different people have different criteria. And if you have an argument that makes sense, I get it. Like, let's talk about it. I hear you. I think that's fun. I, as a 12, 13-year-old, was team Tracy McGrady should be the MVP all the time in Orlando. Because what do they do without him? And my dad looked at me like I was dumb. But he listened to me. He listened to me. He let me make my argument. And then he told me, but. And I was like, okay, that makes sense. But still, he's the most valuable. Like, that should be the fun of the topic. Mm-hmm. If we actually have the conversations. But once it becomes like, it goes left and into, well, this happened. So it, like, no, appreciate all the greatness. Make your case for your player that you think you believe in.
Yeah.
Someone may disagree, but that's the beauty of it. Instead of Chris Paul's leadership is number one in MVP voting.
That might be the only MVP conversation I don't like.
The Paul stuff is like, do you know how upset I was last year when I had to take the anti-Paul stance? You know how annoyed that made me specifically.
When did you take the anti-Paul stance?
Oh, don't do this. The pod is out there. The tweets are out there. The pod is out there. Absolutely not. We're not.
Check the transcripts real quick.
We are not. Absolutely not. We are not doing this. We got a video clip out there for a promo clip and everything. No. I was very much, because Chris Paul was like one of 16 players that people tried to push last year as the MVP over Jokic. No.
To the Spo and Heat point, you know, like I think that if I wasn't a regular listener of this podcast, I'd be a little bit worried right now. But this is just how you guys talk, so it's all good.
Like, MVP talk always gets me riled up. This is all right.
I do want to issue an apology before we do move on. You were anti Chris Paul being ahead of Jokic last year, so my apologies, Nikias. However, in August 2016, you said maybe this is the year Chris Paul finally gets MVP, and you said it in 2014, if this isn't the year for Chris Paul to win MVP. Again, in 2017, this seems to be a trend. See if I got a 2018 here.
You know, see, here's the thing, right? If Chris Paul gets the MVP he should have gotten in 2008, we don't have to talk about any of this anymore.
2013.
Okay. Could have did it. He didn't.
Oh, what you just said, you actually said on July 8th, 2014, I think Chris Paul would be viewed differently if he won the MVP in 08 like he was supposed to.
Yeah. There we go.
Consistency.
There we go.
Much a Paul-esque consistency, I might
see, say. See, this is, and that also comes full circle. We here. All right. We have a couple of Celtics questions from our loyal dunkers. This one comes from Sam. It says, the Celtics have made a surprising surge lately and have gone from intriguing to interesting to dominant. Most of the talk about them has been about their defense. So my question is, how do you think teams will try to attack them in the playoffs? What, if any, are their weak spots defensively? Will teams just try to run against them before they're set, or will teams try to get them in rotation to see if they can beat them with ball movement? Sierra, what do you think?
They'll try, you know. I don't really think the Celtics have a lot of weaknesses on defense, but I think if there are ways to score against them, like what you want to have at least four shooters on the floor. You want to move the ball well. And you want to just, honestly, you just want to have good scorers. Like, you just want to have guys that can make tough shots. And which is to say, like, the Nets, the Warriors. There we go. The Mavericks win against them was, I think, informative in a way, right? Where you have a guy in Luka that's just kind of, you know, over the course of a series is going to be able to have moments where no matter what the defense is, like, he just has unstoppable stretches, right? Not all the time, but he will. And then, you know, Kevin Durant as well, for the most part, you know, generally unbothered by the presence of Robert Williams or whoever it might be. That's essentially, I think, what the formula is against Boston. Like, the way to beat them in the playoffs is probably just going to be that their offensive firepower is not going to be enough for some of the best defenses, for some of the best defenses in the league. But yeah, they're really hard to score against. Like, I struggled with this question because for the most part, like, almost every team has some sort of defensive limitation, right? But like, you look at this team and it's just like their isolation defense is, I say like when in doubt ISO, but for them, it's like they're very creative with like how they stop you in isolation too. Like just like what they did against Jokic was incredible. Like the day-to-day defensive adjustments have been really cool to watch. And, you know, so in general, yeah, like I say, you know, when in doubt, I'm dope, but that's very difficult to do unless you have like, but, you know, if you have like a team like the Nets, if you have like a scorer like Kyrie Irving, who is just going to be able to make tough shots over you from time to time, like consistently, like that's probably the best way to beat them, which is to say like they just don't have weaknesses. They, at least like in my eyes, what do you guys think?
I was going to say the best way to beat them is probably to score.
Yeah.
I mean, no, not just to score, but like stop them on the other end and get some easy baskets, not be in the half court the whole time. That Boston starting lineup is so tricky because they have size, they have length, they have versatility, and then they can do really weird things matchup wise with Tatum and Brown, just put them on different people to where now actions you weren't thinking was going to be a switch is, and now you don't know where to pinpoint or attack. Al Horford holding up against the scoring guards. You know, we talked about the week he had having to guard Trae Young, Ja Morant, Kyrie Irving, and that helps your defense. Robert Williams emerging as a switch big. They can mix in a drop. So it just makes it tough to pinpoint exactly one thing. I think you've got to be able to move the ball. You've got to be able to be consistent. You can't play slow, and you have to get through multiple actions. Or, as stated, have bucket getters that will help balance those possessions where Boston is really getting into you defensively. So yeah. There's no real one weakness for me, unless you're going to get to their bench lineup. You've got to try and find a matchup that makes Boston think, or try and find some spacing that makes them pause, or have a lineup where you have four or five threats out there to maybe take away some of the help they show at times. But yeah, it's going to be tough.
Really tricky.
No, what they've done as far as, hey, we're switching, but we're only switching these people, but you don't really know that because we're not telling you right away, but then we do it, so now you're expecting it, but then we change. Like, their adjustments defensively on the fly, that consistency has been huge compared to where they were at the start of the season, where you could see they were trying to do it, but it wasn't consistent. They would stop guarding. Now these guys are just all over it.
The other thing is, like, if you want to go five out on them to counter their defense, they do play Time Lord and Horford at the same time, and Jaylen Brown is your three. That is, for, you know, whoever you want to call it, like whether it's Jaylen or Jason, those are both like just two huge guys to have at your two and three. You know, you're just going to get out rebounded. So that's like, that's a problem on the other end. Like, there's very few starting fives that'd be able to kind of contend with them on offense without getting completely beat up on the other side of the floor. Like, watching them against Denver, like, there is a point where they had, like, the Jokic and DeMarcus on at the same time to kind of try to make that happen. And, you know, it was a little bit too, like break emergency glass type of moment, right? Like, it was like the game was out of hand. But it was just really interesting to watch that type. Like, they've now gotten to the point where they're inspiring things like that.
Yeah. They are insane. Like, I think if you're going to try to pinpoint, I don't think they have weak spots defensively. I mean, they're the best defense in basketball for a reason. If you're going to target weaker spots, like, I think your best way of attacking Boston is if you try to engage Robert Williams in drop whenever he's in a drop, since he's simply good and not great at it. And so if you run like some ball screens with like, if you run some ball screens to engage Robert Williams and you have like a single shooter on the weak side, and Jaylen Brown's defended that guy because as good as he can be on ball, he does have some lapses off ball, then place him in some pick your poison. Do I tag here or do I stay on the shooter situations? And maybe you can get some stuff out of that. But even that only goes so far between they just switch the matchups because they have the athleticism and the length and IQ to do that.
And you still got Horford there, right? Yeah. Like, it gives Robert Williams a little bit more give too, where he can, you know, if he wants to drop back a little bit more on defense, or if he wants to play a little more aggressively, that's fine too. And Jaylen and Jason, like, they can just bump guys on the side. Like, they can send, like, they're really long too. Mm-hmm. Like, it just gives, they all help each other really well too. Like, you know, we talk about Horford's sort of defensive renaissance, and he's definitely, like, something definitely happened, right? But at the same time, I think a lot of it is just the fact that if you do get beat, it's okay because there's going to be somebody behind you. Like, it's just like, that's kind of the beautiful thing of having two guys that can actually protect the rim on the floor together as well. Like, you know, watching the early parts of that Warriors game before Steph was out too, like, you just notice, like, Horford could just be way out on Steph in a way that I don't think he would be if he didn't know that Williams was there behind him.
Mm-hmm. The more we talk about it, like, I feel like we're doing the opposite of answering the question and just talking about how good Boston is on defense, which I'm totally down with. But, like, they're just so good at doing multiple things. Like, there's no exploit, you know? Usually when the team runs a scheme, you know, hey, they're mm-hmm. doing this, we can find X. But you don't know if they're going to switch, being a drop, or Marcus Smart's going to decide, hey, I'm just going to go under. Okay, so now that pick and roll is busted. Let's try some dribble handoffs. Oh, they switched it. Sweet. Let's try and drive an attack that kept the ball in front and helped. Great. So that, like, that versatility is going to help them in the playoffs, and that versatility makes it just tough. Like, it's just tough.
I would have been really curious to see how that Warriors game would have ended if Steph didn't get hurt, because there were a lot of, like, for as good as they were, there were offensive rebounds and there were just other moments where they did get discombobulated just by the fact of Clay, Steph, and Jordan Poole at the same time, right? And the East version of that exists too in the Nets with Curry on the team now. Like, I would have been a seven-game series with Boston against either of these two teams, I'd be incredibly psyched for that reason. I just want to see, like, what kind of breaks first. Like, does Boston eventually just get too confused because that's, like, what those teams do to everybody else? Or are they going to be the guys that kind of, like, are able to somehow stop all of that? I have my doubts. I kind of just feel like in the playoffs, better offense will end up trumping great defense. But it would be fun to watch.
I'm with you. All right, we have another Celtics question. We've been talking a lot about adjustments and such. This comes from Christine, who made Dunker Spot Bingo for us. So thank you for that. She says, originally, I was team M.A. Udoka has been great, but I don't think he deserves Coach of the Year votes because of the slow start. Do y'all think that how dominant the Seas have been lately will get him votes? Do you think where the Celtics finish seeding-wise will have a big impact, if so? I'll let you take that one, Siri. My bad.
I thought you were going to lead the dance. Mr. Ime Udoka should be Coach of the Year, said in August.
Oh, is that your soapbox?
That was my preseason pick, and then Boston was, you know, they did some things in the beginning of the year.
Man sold that ticket.
Look, man, it was not looking great for Ime Udoka, and now Boston. Yeah,
that pick had just, you know, it went through a lot.
I'm so much cowardice. I would just stuck with it because I had to read the article to confirm. I'm like 90% sure. I know I had Ime Udoka as my Coach of the Year pick. I think I had Boston finishing third this year. Mm-hmm. And so now if it ends up that way, I can't even celebrate the way that I want to, because I was just like, not Atlanta done like I am now, but like I was pretty done with how Boston was looking earlier in the year. And now they just completely flipped the switch in 2022. So that's just, you know, that's just a nail I have to take. On the MA front, he Coach of the Year feels like a 11 coach field this year. So, like, I guess he's one of the guys that could get a vote.
He's in the conversation.
Yeah, he's in the conversation. I think we have the podcast title. Weird. Siri, what do you think?
Oh no, I definitely I would probably he's definitely jumped up for me. He's not going to be my Coach of the Year. I think honestly, like I feel like it's Monty Williams for me, and it's just not really that close. Because the way that I look at Coach of the Year too is I kind of look at it as a cumulative award. Like a lot of these awards, like Executive of the Year, Coach of the Year, they're kind of flawed because most of the time, like the spoils of what has happened is due to what, you know, the foundation that was laid down before. And usually you don't get to reward the same coach for that because there's so much turnover in the league. You know, like if you look at the Celtics, right? Like a lot of like this has been burgeoning for a while, right? Like we now have like Tatum, like completely unlocking his scoring game, improved decision-making, playmaking. Jaylen Brown's slowly figuring out how to not have like as much tunnel vision. But these are all incremental improvements that have all, like, they've taken a while to come to fruition, right? And a lot of that was Brad Stevens. And with the Suns, like Monty Williams is a coach that actually happened to lay down the foundation for what is now, like, the number one seed. So I'm going to take the opportunity there to just be able to vote for him, for sure. And, like, you know, same goes for a coach like Taylor Jenkins as well. But I do think, like, the other end of that is, you know, I think he might get punished for the Celtics total wins. But then if you just look at the turnaround, you know, being able to steady the ship after that definitely deserves some consideration. And for me, he's third. That's where I have him. He's third behind those guys for that reason. Like, he kind of recently overtook a bigger staff for me, just because, like, if now looking at the Cavs, like, they are skating a little bit, but if you also just look at the personnel, I think it's more evident now that they're just more talented than we thought they were in the preseason.
All right, Steve, what about you?
I think it's a great coaching job, just in the wrong year, honestly. Just with where he started, with how many coaching jobs happened. So mm-hmm. I can totally understand Ime being third, but for me, Monty's one, and then having to choose two for Spo, Taylor Jenkins, and JB sounds tough. Now you add Ime to the mix, and it's like, well, what do you do here? So for me, it would be, do you take what Ime has done turnaround-wise in year one, stabilizing and then to making this run, or do you salute JB Bickerstaff for turning Cleveland into this? Like, I don't know how you – I think that's where it gets tough, though. I still have Monty Spo and Taylor Jenkins for me. If there was five, he would be in it, I think. But at three, see, it gets tricky, though, because what if they, like, end up as the one seed in the East?
And they're, what, two and a half right out? There.
Yeah, one and a half.
Everybody's one and a half behind Miami. What if Philly wins, Nikias?
No.
No respect for Glenn.
No, Doc Rivers not your coach of the year.
No, he's not my coach of the year. He's done a good job. I can't get coach of the year. Well, go ahead, Steve. What you got?
He changed the playbook a little. Yeah, he's grading against his own curve. He's doing pretty good.
Oh man. He doesn't have a guy to run floppy with. It's great. That was for you, Steve. I needed that reaction right there. That's all I needed. All right, we have a couple from Always. The first one, being a Rockets fan, I get a firsthand look at Christian Wood's defensive shortcomings. He seems to always get a lot of buzz during the offseason and trade deadline, but watching him makes me wonder if a player of Wood's archetype, great scorer, good shooter, but majorly lacking in defense and passing field, can actually be a starting five on a championship team. Wouldn't your center being a net negative on defense substantially lower your team's ceiling? Do you have extensive Christian Wood thoughts?
Not extensive Christian Wood thoughts, but I do think it's a good question. I answer this is absolutely yes. Like, you need a lot of, like, the four position just needs to be a lot more versatile. I think playmaking even more than defense. Like, you can make up for certain things on defense now. That you probably couldn't before, especially, like, you know, the amount of perimeter oriented schemes designed to hide, like, a bad four now in the NBA. Like, I don't know how those will hold up in the playoffs. I'm really curious to see, like, you know, the Wolves and the Bulls, how that does. But you need playmaking at that position, right? Like, we're going to talk about this later with Ayton, right? But just having that hub that catches the ball at the center of the floor, you know, if you can just help on that guy, and he's either going to take, like, a bad floater, or he's going to turn it over and he's not going to see the corner shooter. Like, that is just the easiest way to stop a defense or stop an offense. And it's just, you know, I don't know. It just, it causes like a serious scare in the issues, like right in the middle of the floor. So, yeah. I mean, Rob Maloney actually wrote a really good piece about this, like, I think like a year and a half ago, about just like the evolution of that position, like the necessity now of, you know, having a player like, you know, Bam Adebayo in that position, I think was like the archetype that he used. But there's a number of players that do that now. And yeah, I think it's a bang on sort of observation by what was the name of that?
Always.
Always. Okay. Cool.
All right, Steve, what about you?
It's going to be tough to go very far if your center has severe limitations and is in the liability zone. Now, the counter I would say is it depends on what the roster looks like. Do you have the perimeter wing defenders to navigate to take the pressure off of him? Can you find a coverage that works for him? Because we've seen players that have those kind of limitations just kind of find their thing. Maybe he goes to a different scenario and looks different, a la Brook Lopez, who was a question mark at one point defensively and was a person that teams targeted in the fourth quarter in pick and roll and then became king of the drop. Mm-hmm. So for me, I don't know if I would cap his ceiling until I saw him somewhere else. I don't know if it's Houston. I don't know if it's just him. But if we're talking big picture, it's tough when your center is not able to hold it down in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. And is someone who can be attacked. So, yeah, I probably vibe with that.
I'm with you. Like, I think we need to see Christian Wood in a different context. Because I think just looking at his skill set defensively, like, he does have solid mobility when he's engaged. Like, I think he's better at switching and showing high than he is in a drop. He is a disaster in a drop. So he, if we're going to go with an analog on a good team, I think the closest thing, I think a nice reference point would be Bobby Portis, actually, to where you could see, like, the first half of this season when Brook Lopez went down and Milwaukee's like, all right, cool, we're just going to show two to the ball all the time. Bobby Portis was fine because he was able to get out, show high, and then you have Giannis roaming around that. And that's why they were able to hover around the top eight, top 10 before teams were like, okay, cool, we're just going to string this out. Or wait, you guys are actually kind of small when Giannis is off the floor. So now we're just going to pass around and shoot a bunch of threes and stuff. But that goes to show you that A, it can work if you had a personnel. B, there are still limitations if that's all you can do. And so I would like to see Christian Wood on, like, if Christian Wood was in Boston right now, I think he'd be fine. Like, I think he's best at switching, and they have the kind of personnel to make that work to where he isn't going to be super exploited.
If he was in Boston, he'd be the answer to the question we had earlier.
That's a good shot. That's a good shot. But, like, I'm saying, like, that's the kind of context. Look, I mean, Boston's the best team in the league, so I don't want to make it, like, extreme. But, like, in general, a switchy unit with guys that can cover for him is the kind of context that he needs. And so if you're able to find answers for him, if he has a defensive infrastructure that can hide him a little bit, then you look at what he does offensively as a guy that can beat switches, as a guy that can shoot, as a guy that slips 90% of his screens, but he is a very good role man. Like, there's utility for him on a good team. And then the second question, as we have seen from the best passers in the league, playmaking can come from players of different sorts and sizes. What differences do you see in offenses when the main source of playmaking is coming from a guard creator versus from a passing hub center? Is there an advantage to either one, or does elite playmaking have the same impact no matter where it comes from? I like this question. Steve, I'll let you start this one off.
That's a good question. The difference in offenses when the main source of, I guess it's what you run and how you get the playmaking potentially. If the hub is going to be the center, you're probably going to have more movement. If it's a playmaking guard, they're probably bending defenses with their talent and you're getting more skip passes, you're getting more scoring roles. With a passing hub center, it's going to be a lot more cutting, movement, reading the defense type of deals. As far as an advantage goes, I think a passing hub center may give you more versatility set-wise, but a guard creator could potentially cause more havoc, if that makes sense, because you don't necessarily know what the playmaking is going to be, and they have the threat of scoring. Whereas the greatness of the playmaking hub center-wise is going to be based on some movement, some action, that type of deal. I guess maybe it's just but there's value in that passing hub center because they're such a connector piece. So now I've talked myself into being on the fence again.
This is how you know we have a great question.
It's a special talent. I'm going to still go guard creator. I think that's the advantage.
All right, Sierra, what about you?
I think the way this question was framed, I was kind of wondering, like, if it wasn't more about, like, hey, is it? I mean, the answer would be obvious, but it's kind of like, do you want to have two creative hubs or one? So I think no matter what, like, I was kind of going through all the teams you could look at. Like, you could look at Jokic with the Nuggets, right? And it's a system that is definitely different than, let's say, Luka and the Mavs. But their key limitation is that there is one playmaking hub. And I think what makes a team like the Warriors so versatile is that it's Curry and Draymond. And right now, I think this whole season has been a fight over like who's more trash, Steph or Draymond, based on who's out, which is just the worst way to watch the Warriors. But hey, I guess that's how we talk about sports now. you need both of them, and that's essentially like what can make your offense really versatile. But like I think you can see like with the way that, you know, the Nuggets got beat in the playoffs last year, just like, you know, the ways that they can get beat in the regular season now is that no matter what your system is, like I think, you know, having a guy like him, you know, in the sense that they have him in, like it gives them a lot more versatility. But at the same time, like it's one guy, and a good defense is going to figure that out. I think it's all just about having two different hubs, and then naturally, like they would kind of tend to position themselves in that orientation, at least on the offenses that kind of fit the best together. As the Suns doing pretty well with Book and Chris Paul too.
I would say, and truthfully, this is something that I should have like looked up before the pod, but like off the top of my head, like I feel like the main difference between the two would be the kind of shots that you create. Because if you are using like a guy like Jokic in the high post, or even Draymond in the high post, like I feel like teams that are geared around like a passing hub center are generally creating more shots at the rim with those cuts, with those flat sections and things like that. Like you can flow into handoffs and try to get a guy downhill as well. But like I think in general, it kind of skews towards trying to get interior buckets. Whereas the guard creator, like if we're looking at the Hawks with Trae Young, like Trae wants to pull up or get downhill and then spray it out. Mm-hmm. And so I think the guard creators are more likely to generate like a high three-point rate team, whereas the passing hub center is more likely to get you more via like cuts and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, am I off on that?
No, I was thinking that. I was thinking that when I was thinking about the answer to this. Then I just started kind of that's essentially how I landed on the answer that I had. But yeah, no, that's a really good point. Because I think it's just like when you have the passing hub out there, it just naturally creates a little bit more space down low anyway. Mm-hmm. And then like you kind of have like a solar system kind of moving around them. And then like with guards, like there's a lot more standing around.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Steve.
I'm intrigued now that you brought that up, because now I'm thinking about different types of guard creators and which ones are we talking about? Are we talking about what Chris Paul does manipulating in pick and roll? Or are we talking about the chaos that a Trae Young brings in pick and roll? Or are we talking about the control that Luka may have with his size? Like which one of those would you take? Or a James Harden, where I can do this via ISO or pick and roll? Mm-hmm.
I don't honestly see a huge difference between what all four of those guys do. I would just take the player that I think is best out of them. Okay. Different styles and ways that they do it. And, you know, one guy might prefer a certain pass over the other one, but a lot of it is just kind of like pick and roll and watching what the other guy is doing. Now, the Suns have a little creativity in their system baked in, right? But I think the Hawks on some level do too, but it's also just like standing there and watching Trae Young do that over and over again lends itself to standing around, just like it does for the Mavericks. I've been meaning to ask, by the way, since you brought it up earlier, when did you jump off of the Hawks? Because I also recently did that, and it took me pretty much all season. I think it took me until like John Collins indefinitely out, which was not long ago. But
it was the loss to the Hornets a week ago that broke me.
Sounds like you guys jumped off at the same time.
Yeah. I called them the Cobb County Hawks on the pod. And I was like, you know what? This is probably where I'm at. Like, this is Trey's been great.
Good for him.
I'm tired of watching this defense. Like,
pass the ball, bro.
It's
you know, before the last 10 seconds of shot clock. I mean, before somebody tells me, yes, he's getting career highs or whatever. Yeah, I'm very frustrated by that team.
Same. Honestly, that could have been the podcast we wanted to shift it that way.
I'm like, no, I want to, we got to keep the vibes high going into the playoffs.
There we go.
Yeah.
Somebody has to have good vibes around these parts. But yeah, like I think the shot selection is a little bit different depending on what type of hub you have. Like I would, even then I'm kind of torn because like in a vacuum, like I would probably rather have the guard creator. There are just more options, more ways to bend defense, but also like what Jokic does and being able to bring a center away. Like he isn't your traditional dump it down, let him spray cuts guy. Like he can do that, then also face up and score, can also face up, take a couple dribbles, turn it into a post up. He can step out and shoot. Like he's Jokic is.
I think Sabonis might be.
Yeah,
Sabonis. Like what the Kings are doing. Yeah.
Yeah, like that would probably be a better or closer thing. In which case, like I would still take the guard creator in that case. Like I think there are just more. There are just more ways to bend defense in that way. Because even with like the Trae Young example earlier, like those guards want to manipulate help and you can get more threes that way. But also you get deep enough in the paint. Like there are lobs. There are guys you can hit on cuts as well. It's just a different look. So I would lean towards the guard creator. Our last one is going to come from Kyle, who is asking this question in light of last night's Timberwolves-Suns game. With Ayton's critical development in the short role this season, being quicker and more confident with his catch and shoot mid-range and making better passing reads against the defense after they trap pick and rolls, and his improved hook shot punishing teams that switch too flippantly, does this change how you think teams will attack Phoenix defensively? Do you see teams blitzing less pick and rolls in an effort to decrease the good looks Ayton and the other role players get against the scheme while conceding Book and Chris Paul might not have to work as hard for their own offense? Or would teams rather live with not allowing those two to go off and forcing the rest of the Phoenix rotation to beat them? I will give the floor to you, Siri.
Yeah, I think this just makes the Suns like a little bit more impossible, right? Like looking at that game, that second half, they just got cut apart by the fact that, like, you know, what do you do when you're trapping Devin Booker? And then, you know, every time Ayton came up to catch it at the free throw line, that just sets up a whole bunch of impossible situations. Like the only time the Wolves ever really even had a shot there was when, you know, Ayton would roll low to the rim to try to get the lob, and you couldn't, you know, you just couldn't find the angle for the lob pass. And then, you know, there might be out of options, but they're also, man, like this is like a team of destiny. Cause like in the fourth quarter, when that happened, Booker passed the ball off the backboard and got it to Mikhail on the cut, who he was trying to get it to, but was definitely not trying to get it to off the backboard. Like there is just like they're just rolling in this unprecedented way where things like that just happen. Like it kind of reminds me of like when we'd watch like the Warriors in 2016, they'd get like, you know, 50-50 balls to the point where it felt like it was like a 75-25 ball if the Warriors were playing, right? Mm-hmm. It's just kind of impossible. Because now, like if you I would say the best move is still going to be to, you know, not blitz and then just try to see what you can do against Ayton one-on-one in those scenarios and continue to test him. But he is also just like, you know, the guy, there's a reason the guy was number one pick, right? Like he has a lot of offensive potential that he's tapping into right now. And it seems like, you know, since he's been off of, you know, he was injured earlier in the season, but you know, since he's been back, every week I tune into the Suns and I'm like, oh, there's a new thing in Ayton's bag. Like, oh, there's just like, oh, this is, there's a finish from him that I didn't see before. Or, hey, like, you know, just, you know, every once in a while he makes a three now. And that just, yeah, like that to me is, that's going to probably continue to happen. And it's, I guess, what you live with, but I don't know. The guy put up 35 points last night. I guess the thing is like, that doesn't happen every night. And until it does, I think you can live with it. But I think it's just because, like, it's like the best option out of like some really horrible options if you're the defense. The other option is like, you know, you leave, you know, Devin Booker, who's cooking on an island, or you leave Mikal Bridges or Cam Johnson open. And like, you know, you don't even have Chris Paul right now. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it should actually change things too much because, you know, the scenarios are impossible.
It's going to be the lesser of evil. Steve, what do you think?
Yeah.
I think it's just tough with what Phoenix does and with how Ayton is playing. It's difficult because not only do they hurt all your defenses, they hurt them before you even get a chance to really get a feel on it. And so it's hard to pick a poison. I don't know if you can straight blitz Phoenix with Ayton short roll. I don't know if you can play drop with Booker and Paul's shot making and still ability to play make. So it's going to have to be a mix. You're probably going to have to lean on some switches. You're going to have to be able to do multiple things. I thought the most creative thing that Minnesota at least tried was, hey, let's flip the matchups and let's try and put Vanderbilt on Ayton. Let's try and make that a pick and roll a switch. Take Cat out of it, see how that works, which is okay until you remember what DeAndre Ayton does against switches. So that's another aspect of it, to where they kind of have an answer for everything. So this is a team that you're going to have to be able to have either find a way to neutralize a matchup, one of those three, with one of your players, or find a way to mix schemes and try and keep them off balance to where they're not able to pick you apart. Because we've seen it before, whether it was last year in the playoffs, last night against the Wolves, when they know what you're going to do and you keep doing it, they're just going to hit you until you break. So you're going to have to find a way to bring multiple things to the table and at least make them think. That's why I think a team like, I want to see them in the first round against a team like the Clippers to see what kind of things get thrown at them and how they react to it.
That's a good call. Like, I think I'm with both of you that you're going to have to do different things against Phoenix. You got to throw them off. Like, I think your best 10,000-foot view answer against Phoenix offensively is to try to flatten them out with switching. Because, like, they're in the, you know, how we've talked about Utah throughout this pod's history. Like, if they get you in rotation, you're in trouble. If Phoenix gets you in rotation, you're just in trouble. And so whether it's drop or you're sending two to the ball with those traps, like, if you're giving Phoenix a rotation of some sort, even if you're locked in, they have answers for it. And if you aren't locked in, they're just going to completely tear you apart. Like, what DeAndre Ayton was able to do in short roll was incredible. Like, a mixture of jumpers, push shots, floaters. He hit a three when they laid off of him. Like, it might not be 35 every night, but, like, we've seen this. Steve Mitchell and DeAndre Ayton operating like he has a substitute teacher in the room when Chris Paul was down. And he started experimenting with those threes. Heading into tonight's action, like, they're currently playing Denver right now, but heading into tonight's action, he's shooting basically 62% between 3 and 10 feet, which is insane with his volume. One of the questions I had before the year and last season too, but especially heading into the year, was like, the one thing is, how do they generate rim pressure, especially if you do switch against Paul and Booker? And the answer has been, okay, we don't have to get all the way to the rim. We'll just let DeAndre Ayton hook and push shot you and mid-range jumper you to death. And he's doing that at a high level. And so if he's punishing switches too, like, I echo both of your sentiments. It's a pick your poison ordeal. You're not going to feel great about anything. I don't think it changes anything really. Like, I think you want to stay out of rotation against Phoenix any way that you can. And so I think switching is going to be the answer that a lot of teams land on anyway. And if Ayton's doing this, then I don't know what you do with that in conjunction with what Devin Booker brings to the table. Good freaking look to the Western Conference. All right. Thank you for all of our dunkers sending in questions. Again, if you have questions for us throughout the week, hit us up at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. We are going to cap things off with our free throw segment, but we are going to shoot some questions to our guests.
Yahoo email address, by the way.
You saw what, now?
Respect the Yahoo email address, by the way.
Oh, Jesus. All right. Sierra, I have some questions for you before you get out of here. Is that cool?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. DeJounte Murray or Shai Gilgeous-Alexander?
Oh, right now, Murray. If I was saying, like, who's my franchise player, I'd say Shai.
All right. Better in the high post, Alperen Şengün or Scotty Barnes?
Oh, come on, Scotty all the way. Scotty all the way.
All right. Rank these passers: Trae Young, Darius Garland, LaMelo Ball.
Trae Young, LaMelo Ball. Mm-hmm. Cool. Is this rapid fire? Did I already, like, lose by doing this?
No, you're good.
Okay. Trae Young, Darius Garland, LaMelo Ball.
All right, rank these passers: DeMarcus Cousins, Mason Plumlee, Isaiah Hartenstein.
Cousins. Plumlee Hartenstein.
Hmm. Why Plumlee over Hartenstein?
Because the truth. Oh.
Stand up for your guy, Mason Plumlee. I respect.
He's a good passer.
I'm just messing with you. Who do you trust more in the playoff setting right now, Miami or Golden State?
Golden State.
All right. Similar vein, Jordan Poole or Tyler Hero?
Jordan Poole.
Ooh. Okay. That's all I have. Steve, do you have questions for our guest?
Who do you trust more in the playoffs, Tobias Harris or George Niang?
Yeah, I was going to say whoever. Tobias Harris.
Poor Tobias. Wow.
Another poor shot for Unrelias Harris. What playoff team are you most concerned about?
Playoff team that am I most concerned about? Philly.
Which playoff narrative is going to annoy you the most?
Ooh, I mean, we already talked about it. The Chris Paul MVP candidacy. And by the way, as a Chris Paul fan, as a big Chris Paul fan, that is still going to be the most annoying one, for sure.
Solidarity, wow.
What first round series do you want to see the most?
Oh, good question. I would really love like a Nets Sixers first round series.
Got you.
It'd be so dramatic. Either of those teams losing in the first round to each other.
Twitter's gonna be a mess.
I also agree. You pick one of these players who's gonna swing a play-in game. Marcus Morris Sr., Jalen Noel, Malik Monk, or Devontae Graham?
I'm gonna go Devontae Graham.
That's all I had.
Yeah.
All right, good stuff. Sir, where can the people find you? What are you working on? What should we be looking forward to?
You can find me at The Ringer. I host a podcast every week with Chris Ryan. I'm writing stuff, but...
Don't want to get burnt, but that's a veteran writer move. I need to start doing that. That's some good stuff. All right, thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe to us, leave us a review, leave us 5 stars. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us. You can find me on Twitter at NikaiasNBA. You can find Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.
Did you know rocket scientists know about defense?